I'm Aragon Starr. I'm from the Kickapoo tribe of Oklahoma.
And talk about the character Super Indian. He got his powers after eating tainted government cheese.
Yes, he did. And that's the whole comedy situation for this particular character. It was important for me to have humor in a comic because a lot of the stuff is a little too serious, maybe a little bit too adult. I really wanted to reach kids, preteens, but also to reach their parents as well and the elders. So I was like, okay, what do we like? What do I like? And I like to laugh, and that's one thing that Native people have this in common, and people do not know that we are funny, funny people.
What powers did he get after eating the cheese?
Well, he's starting to get a little bit of flight. He's got the ice breath, the heat breath. He's super strong, and he's developing things as we speak. I mean, I'm getting into volume 3, so he's going to get some more powers.
Cool. It's kind of subversive, though.
It's way subversive, and that's the thing. You can kind of hide the stuff in, like, oh, it's a kid's book. Oh, it's a comic. It's like, yeah, not really, but that's okay. If you want to look at it that way, fine.
You had one comic where the villain is an evil anthropologist.
You know, people get money to study us, and we're just objects. We're not people. We're not human. And I thought, that's what happens, you know, especially in cultures like Germany, where they have clubs, they have powwow clubs. They dress up, they have teepees, they have powwows in Germany. And these are clearly not Native people, but there it is. It's this weird Native love where you go, what?
I saw that you made him German.
Yes, of course, yes. That's a little homage.
I heard you mention some other ones. Who are some of the other sort of villains or other characters, like you had the New Ager?
Oh, yeah, Vivian Hardy, who owns the Crystal Visions shop. Just on the reservation border, the town nearest to them is called Spendy Oaks. And Vivian set up her New Age shop, and she's an agent of wampum bags who has the circle of evil.
And then you talked about there's a teacher who becomes a nemesis to Super Indian.
In fact, that is Wampum Bags. He was formerly known as Jürgen Sturms, a wonderful Swedish teacher who came to the reservation and just saw that, why aren't people learning their culture? Well, I don't understand. So he wanted to take on the power because if nobody else is going to do it, why not me? And so stealing the wampum belt, he has imbued himself with a lot of power. And that's why he's like, this reservation will be mine and all of its secrets. He doesn't even know about the enchanted forest where they buried the resium in the soil, and things are happening out there that, you know, it's like, it's forbidden. You have to have certain knowledge to go out there. And I'm sure that that's something he's going to try to get his little paws into at some point.
What inspired that?
You know, I have to say that there's a lot of people in my travels, as you know, when I was working as a musician, working as an actor, a playwright, and all the other things that I do, that you come across people like at powwows. There's always like one or two people that are more Indian than thou. And, you know, I've been told, you know, it's like they look at me as like, you know, well, I know more about your culture than you do, and I'm like, what? Wait a minute. This
are
is
these
crazy.
Indians or?
No, usually not. It's usually the guy that's like, you know, I'm 164th Cherokee on my, you know, grandmother's side. And it's usually all a little sketchy. So, you know, it's one of those like, this is sketchy, way sketchy. And you're telling me how I'm supposed to be. I've had that happen to me at a Cherokee stomp dance in Oklahoma, where this guy who thought he was all that and Indian and a bag of chips told me how I was to stomp dance and how I was to conduct my, I was like, whoa, step back, Jack. Who are you? You know, so those kind of things have happened to me. And I'm just reporting. I'm just doing what you're doing.
So you started Super Indian as a radio show, and then it morphed into a comic book. Was that always what you planned? Why did you want to start it that way?
Well, the radio show came first because of Native Voices at the Autry. They had gotten a grant to do radio theater, and Native Voices at the Autry was set up as a Native American theater company where they nurture playwrights and actors and such. So they knew me as an actor, but also a musician, but they also knew that I had this idea for a comic, and they said, why don't you adapt that into a 10-minute play? We took it to the West Audio Theater Festival in Missouri, and we did a 10-minute version of Super Indian that was broadcast on NPR back in the day. I think that was like 2005 or 2006. And that became so popular, they said, well, let's order some more episodes. So we did 10 5-minute episodes, which they eventually packaged into one show. And we had a blast. All native actors, we had live sound effects. It was taped in front of a live audience, as in the days of old-time radio. And it was a lot of fun. And they wanted to do a second series. The funding just didn't happen. So I had this great idea and nothing to do with it. And I was like, I think I'm going to do that comic book now.
And you, had you been an artist as well? You do all these things.
I've always been an artist as well. And I've always kept my skills up. But I was always sketching, drawing, painting, et cetera, et cetera. But actually doing a comic, I didn't really have the knowledge of how you take, 11 by 17 black and white drawings, turn them into color, add letters, and then publish them to a book. I taught myself how to do that. Mainly because lack of funds. I know you can hire people to do these things, and usually that's how comics are done. There is a writer, there's a separate artist, there's a pencil, there's inks, there's color, and these are all different people. But I just didn't have the money to do that, so I thought, well, I'll learn. And so I did.
I know, I've discovered that here. I didn't know that breakdown in the comics world. So is that how your comics get produced, or do you maintain control of it?
Yeah, no, it starts with the written word. I write my script first, then I do rough sketches, then I refine them, make them inks. Well, this is all digital too. I don't use actual pen and paper anymore. I'm all on the computer. And then add color, and then add the letters, and then set it up in a format. And though this is how comics are produced, this is how it happens. And again, I went to other comic cons and I asked people and I learned from them. So I owe a great debt to a lot of people that were very, very kind and let me ask a lot of questions.
So you did, but that's unusual, right? Because usually you're doing a publisher, you send off the script and all these other people are doing.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, if I was in like the mainstream world and I was a writer for Marvel or whatever, I would just write my script and that would be the end of it. And somebody else would draw it and conceive it and get it done and publish it.
Did that, you had talked about, there was an instance where someone said, we want you to do that, and you said no.
Actually, I've never been approached by any of the majors. This stuff does not translate to the mainstream world at all. And in fact, a lot of people said, wow, you're going to have a really small audience. And I said, that's okay. That is okay. I'm not writing for those people out there. They have Iron Man, they have Deadpool, they have that. We don't have that in our community. So I thought, okay, it's for them, and that's okay. And if it doesn't get any bigger than that, that's okay. I'm doing all right.
This is Women's Focus on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and this is an interview with Aragon Starr. She created the comic Super Indian, who got his powers from eating tainted government cheese. She was at the first Indigenous Comic-Con in Albuquerque in November. Today, I'm running a series of interviews with women I met at the con. I asked Aragon what issues she addresses in her comics.
Everything from cultural appropriation, because that's a really big one, to New Agers. Mostly, what is it to be a Native person in the contemporary world, and how do you navigate? Do you embrace it, or do you shun it?
And so he has a Lex Luthor nemesis who also ate tainted cheese?
Yes, yeah, that's Derek Thunder. And again, self-hating, not really wanting to be a Native person, would rather be something else, and coming back to his people after having been away for a long time and being tutored by the villain Wampum Bags, he's like, hey, I'm going to destroy you guys too. I'm going to build a robot and make you all normal, quote, quote, air quote, normal, and not Indian anymore. It's like, what's that? And how sad that is, because, a lot of people have lost touch and they like, oh, yeah, I'm kind of, sort of,
You had a villain cult, you said, it was a vampire?
Yes.
Called Blood Quantum? Yeah. Talk about that. Talk about those who may not understand that.
Okay. As a lot of people know, there's Being Native, sometimes we compare to being a pedigree dog, because it's like, how much Indian are you? And there's a lot of judgment, even amongst Native people, is like, well, I'm more Indian than you are. Like, what does your BIA or CDIB card say? So in creating this character named Blood Quantum, spelled very, very differently than how it sounds, he has grown up in Albuquerque. And in fact, he's from a proud Spanish family. And he's like one of the originals with Juan Oñate and the whole thing, and just so proud of that. And a hater of Pope, because Pope did bad things to his family, and he's held on to that anger. And he finds himself working at the BIA and just like, oh my God, I hate these people. And he goes on like one of those retreats with, I don't know, how did they find money at the BIA for a retreat? But they go down to Mexico. He encounters a golden cave. He steals some items, and he's cursed by the protectors of this cave to become a vampire. And they told him, they said, in order for you to lift this curse, you must go bite other full-blood Indians until you become one. You will become what you hate. And so that's what he does. He goes back to the BIA, infiltrates, and just kind of made his way to Leaning Oak.
These are really tough issues you're dealing with. Okay, why take it on in this form? Why is this an effective way to get at these issues?
I think because it's sort of like, it's like a little candy all wrapped up all pretty, and you kind of go, ooh, and then you look inside, whoa! it will draw in an audience, and it will affect people. And people, other Native people see this, they pick up the book and they laugh, but then they read it and go, oh. And they still laugh. They still laugh. But it's that, I'm seeing myself finally in the pages of a comic book, and it's done in a good way, and it's done in a way that they don't feel cheapened or demeaned or any of that sort of thing. So that's why.
Talk about your new series about the Code Talkers.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Talk about a labor of love. This thing began as an idea at the Denver Comic Con, and it was because Lee Francis of Native Realities liked one of the images that I had done for our Generation Inc. comic book. It was a group project. It was on the cover. It was a tiny, tiny, tiny image. He said, can you give me a file of that so I can like blow it up and make it a poster? And I said, sure. So we had that poster on our table at the Denver Comic Con, and I cannot tell you how many people stopped and said, I want to buy that. We hadn't done anything with it. We had no stories written. We had nothing but a concept of Tales of the Mighty Code Talkers. Because we all knew that there were other tribes that were involved in the Code Talking project besides the Navajo. So we started our research. I asked other artists and writers to come in and help, and all Native people. And we put the project together, but it's taken a long time for that to happen, well, at least 4 years, for the project to actually come from the idea to a printed book.
Is it a graphic novel? Or?
Yeah, well, yes and no. These are like little vignettes. They're 8 to 10 page stories that focus on one incident. Like, say, here's the story of two Creek soldiers in Sitka, Alaska versus the Japanese. And that's an 8-page story by Johnny Dicon, who is Muscogee Creek from Tulsa. And he was also, because he's a fluent speaker of his language, was able to incorporate his language into the story. And the same with the Comanche story that we did. I asked, you know, a Comanche language expert, Geneva Lofton, to do the translation. So we're trying to do this on multi-levels, A, to get the stories out there, but also to show language and culture.
What's it like being a woman in comics?
Oh, it kind of sucks. I don't know if I can say that, but it's not great because there are women doing this work in the mainstream world. There are, I think I can count 5, maybe 10 that I know of. I know they're out there. We haven't all connected yet, that are creators. Either they're writers or they're artists. So we all try to keep tabs on each other, but when we go to these mainstream conventions, I've just gotten a lot of flack from just non-Indian people going, oh, you drew that? Oh, you wrote that? Oh, isn't that cute? You know, I very diminished and very like, oh, isn't that nice that you draw these pictures? Isn't that sweet? It's kind of gross, but that's happened. That happens a lot. So it's like, oh, well.
So how is it different being here at the Indigenous Comic Con?
Being here at this con is like going to a powwow and coming home and being surrounded by people that understand without explaining, without explanation, know what the drill is. We all have a common base of, you know, cultural knowledge and all this, and nobody has like, yeah, you remember the Trail of Tears? Nobody has to like say, yeah, we know. Anyway, yeah. So it's that's kind of camaraderie.
You don't have to do Indian 101.
Exactly. Not necessary.